Hi everyone, I'm Fran, grateful member of Al-Anon. And I want to thank Ellen and I want to thank Lou for asking me to share today at the Sugarloaf AA Roundup. I'm so happy to be here. There's a lot of people in this room. We came and saw the room earlier and I thought, oh, there won't be that many people there. It's an Al-Anon meeting. There won't be that many people there. So I have to say I'm impressed with your AA and Al-Anon participation at the meeting today. I'm not sure if I'm more nervous for me or if I was more nervous for Ellen in her introduction. And I want to thank my sister. My sister is here. And I want to thank Spencer because he went and got tissues because there's no tissues up here. I said, so the alcoholics never cry? He goes, we never cry. We don't cry. We just tell stories, big stories. So my sister is here. She came, planes, trains, and automobiles. She flew into Logan yesterday morning at 8 a.m. So that means she got up at 3:30 in the morning to come from Cleveland. She worked at the airport, then she went to a coffee shop, she worked. And then I picked her up on the way. And then we didn't know how long the drive was after that. I picked her up north of Boston and I was like, oh my gosh, we got another 4.5 hours to go. Car in front of us almost hit a deer. I mean, we did get here, and we were texting with Lou and Ellen the whole way, and I'd say, oh, we're going to be there about 8, and then it would be like, oh, we had to stop. Oh, we're going to be there at 9, and then we finally got here at 9:30, and we had the most warm welcome when we got here. It was really, really just such a pleasure to meet these two ladies that I've had a texting relationship with for, I don't know, since you asked me. 6 months ago, or maybe longer, I can't even remember. So, thank you. Okay, got the tears out of the way for now. I came into Al-Anon January 7th, 1995. So I've been around for a little bit, but I have to say, the Al-Anon bank account can become overdrawn very quickly, so time really means nothing because you can overdraw your Al-Anon spirit, your serenity and spirituality pretty quickly. I've had the same sponsor for 28 years. She comes out of Texas, so that's a little bit of black belt Al-Anon. As some of you may know, she has over 55 years in this program. And, it's been quite a journey. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, I'm trying to keep time. I want to promise everybody I'm not going an hour and a half. So you can be sure of that. It's 10:25. I'm going to try to keep it to about an hour. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. It's such a journey. Recovery is such a journey. And it's interesting to look back at your life and look at it in retrospect now that I am in recovery and see where alcoholism was alive and well. And obviously I didn't, growing up in a home, nobody tells a young child what alcoholism looks like. So I didn't know. I was living in a home affected by alcoholism. I grew up in upstate New York on a farm. My dad was an apple farmer. My mom was a city girl. She came, she grew up in Montreal, and so she grew up in a city, and she married this country guy. They met at a bar, no surprise. She had been courted by many men, she told us she'd been engaged a few times before, and she ended up marrying my dad, apple farmer from upstate New York. She's a city girl. okay, was a very attractive, kind of a JFK looking guy, really attractive, had a very good, you know, shit eating grin, and he could just get you with his shit eating grin. So he really won her over. And they, you know, they got married and had three kids, and my sister's the oldest, I'm the youngest. And, you know, my dad was a hard worker. He worked in a family business. But when the work day was done, he would come home, he would take a bath or a shower, bath, I think in his case, and then he'd say, I'm just going downtown for a pack of cigarettes. Most times that meant that he came home a lot later, because it only takes about 15 minutes to go down and get a pack of cigarettes. So there was a bar down the road at the end of the street, you know. You know, sometimes he was at the bar. Sometimes he was at the bar. And sometimes he was doing some other things, you know, that alcoholics do. And, you know, but I didn't know. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't even really realize, like, that he came home late. You know, like, my mom was there. She was definitely, and continues to still be, she's 93, she's almost 93, she's still alive, untreated alcoholism, untreated Al-Anonism. She grew up in a home where her parents didn't speak. They didn't talk to one another. So there was a lot of, and her father, at times she has said, oh, I think my father was an alcoholic, and then she'll pull back on that. So, oh, did I really say that one time? You know, so the denial runs thick in the sense of, like, there'll be these moments of, like, oh, yeah, maybe my father was an alcoholic, and then later I didn't say that. So, you know, alcoholism probably did run in the family, and my parents had a pretty tumultuous marriage. Lots of fighting over, you know, money. You know, if the bank account would overdraw, you know, like, my dad wouldn't write the checks in the checkbook. I know some of us remember that, writing checks in the checkbook and, you know, watching your bank account that way versus doing it online. You know, or we would know when my father was walking in the house, there'd be the footsteps and you had to be busy. You had to be doing something, which inherently has turned me into a very type A person who has to be busy all the time, which is perfect for an Al-Anon, you know. You know, we are type A, we are busy, we are doing all the time. And, you know, growing up in this alcoholic home, that was what one of the ways it has manifested in me. I am a control freak. I am a caretaker, a recovering caretaker, a recovering control freak. You know, my mom describes me as, I think I am quite a bit like my dad. I have a little bit of charisma. I was taking my bathing suit off at the beach when I was very young, three or so. I was stripping at the beach. You know, so my love of men started early. you know, I love men. I love alcoholic men. I don't think I've ever dated a man that was not an alcoholic. So, you know. Good for me. Every single one of them was an alcoholic. My high school boyfriend was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. You know, I don't even know how to describe how that happens, but inherently it is part of my existence, part of who I am. It's part of my, if it can be part of your genetic makeup, then I think it is. Like, if, you know, alcoholics have the allergy to alcohol, I have the affinity for the alcoholic men. If I could have been an alcoholic, I would have been an alcoholic, because I too did love to drink. I loved to drink, and I drank with the best of them. Through college, I drank. In college, I really took drinking a little too seriously. That was, like, I studied drinking in college, which led to me getting kicked out of college, and I had to, I consider myself to be a very honest person, but in this case, I was not, you know, so I circumvented the letter that I got kicked out of college before my parents received that letter. And then I actually went over, I was like, oh gosh. So then I went over and talked to the dean at the college. I went to UVM. I went over to the dean and I told her about my parents getting a divorce and how that had really been pretty tumultuous, which it had been tumultuous and was continuing to be tumultuous, but that I needed to switch majors. And then she said, well, if you go to night classes and you do that, then, you know, maybe you can get back into school. My sister probably doesn't even really know this story completely. So here you go. You're going to get the full enchilada today. And so I wrote a check for the tuition that I was going to take the night classes. And then I had to go to my dad and tell him that here are my grades that I didn't want to show him. And then, oh, by the way, I paid the tuition for school, so you need to write me a check to cover that tuition. And he was like, you did what? You wrote a check? That it was, the check was gonna bounce, like a $10,000 check. And I was like, well, I already wrote the check, so you gotta pay the, you gotta reimburse me to cover this check. And he did, but he was not happy. But, you know, I got myself back into school. I had changed majors. I was now an economics major with a business minor. And I kind of cleaned up my act. I didn't drink quite as much anymore. Still, you know, loving all the guys I dated in college. I don't know they all have a diagnosis. I know it's a self-diagnosed disease, but they acted and quacked like alcoholic men. So, you know, that's how that goes. So after college, I graduated from college. I even did it in 4 years. You know, I know, you know, even getting kicked out, I still graduated in 4 years. And I moved to Cape Cod that summer with some friends because I wanted to kind of have my last hurrah before I went and got a real job. And my parents were like, we spent this much money for you to go to college and you're going to go have your last hurrah at Cape Cod. And lo, you know, this is how stories unfold, people. You know, like I went to Cape Cod and I met another alcoholic. And he was like a really big teddy bear type guy. He told me, oh, you're just the best thing since sliced bread. I just love you so much. And like just super warm and fuzzy teddy bear type guy. Well, I had grown up in a house where I really don't think either one of my parents ever said the words, I love you, to me. I don't know, you might be able to confirm that. Nobody said, I love you. And they would say, oh, that's not what you do. Like, you know, it's the Scottish in us or something. You know, we don't tell people we love them, you know. Even our kids, like, we wouldn't tell you I love you. They might tell you through your actions. Because I will say my mother was a loving mother when she wasn't distracted by the alcoholic. You know, she was a loving mother. But this person, this guy, this new guy, who I might add was 16 years older than me. So I was 22. He was 37, 38. 38 at that point. 38 seems so old. But now 38's looking pretty young. But when you're 22 and you're dating a 38-year-old, you're like, people are like, what's going on here, you know? So a little bit of the daddy complex, I'm sure. But, you know, he was very like, I love you so much. I had never heard those words. That was like, I don't even know, like candy on my soul or something, you know, like just the sprinkles and everything on top. Like, this feels good. This feels really, really good. And so lo and behold, you know, we had a sort of on again, off again summer, and I ended up following this guy. And he also was like kind of a bright and shiny guy. He worked in the entertainment business. So he was just doing a sabbatical on Cape Cod as a lobsterman. He was on sabbatical from the entertainment business, but he was driving this POS car, and every Tuesday night he would go someplace that he had to go. So he was going to open AA meetings, and I didn't even know this at the time. He was going to open AA meetings because he had gotten a DUI. But I didn't know because, you know, he loved me so much. He loved me so much. So anyway, I ended up following this guy to California. Like, I'm an East Coast girl, people. I don't move across the country to California. I had dated a guy in high school who was also very infatuated with California. And I was like, I am never moving to California. I don't know what you're talking about. I am an East Coast girl. Don't ever say never to anything, people, because it always comes back and bites you. So I end up moving to California for this one. So I moved to California for this one. We end up getting engaged. I end up marrying this old guy, 38. People are betting in the aisles as to whether he's going to make it to the service, to the wedding, because he was so drunk the night before at the rehearsal dinner. But I'm all in. I'm all in. You know, I'm all in. And, you know, I end up marrying this guy. And he was, I mean, such a very, you know, once again, someone very affected by alcoholism. His father had died of alcoholism. His mother was an alcoholic. I think he had a sister who was an alcoholic. And I, he did end up showing up. Somebody won a lot of money in the betting that day. And we had a beautiful wedding on at a captain's house overlooking, you know, Pleasant Bay or, you know, in Cape Cod. And beautiful, beautiful wedding. And then the fun began. The acquisition had occurred. It was no longer I love you so much. You know, it was the silent treatment. It was, you know, he would be out. He would go on tour. He would be completely drunk or using drugs also. And, you know, I didn't know. I was like, what is going on here? So very early, it was back in therapy. You know, who gets married on June 10th and is in therapy by June 30th? I mean, I don't know. Can anybody raise their hand? You know, and that's kind of how it went. And I was like, what has happened here? What has happened? In the meantime, I'd started a new job because everybody should start a new job right before they're going to get married. And so, you know, people pleaser in me, this person that I was going to work for was like, oh, no, you got to start the job right before you go to get married. I was like, shouldn't I just come back and do it after I get? No, we really need you. People pleaser says, okay, I'm going to start when you want me to start because I'm the good employee. I do what the employer asks. I start this job before I get married. And it's this young, vibrant company. Everybody's like 25. Everyone's good looking. It's in California. They all went to UCLA. They're just, I'm like, oh my God, you know, it's looking very bright and shiny. Oh, look at, you know, he's really cute. These two people are in a couple and these two are getting married. And this is looking pretty interesting. In the meantime, I'm going to therapy 2 weeks after I just got married to the 38-year-old. So anyway, you know, things are not looking good. In the meantime, I'm working away at this company, just bending over backwards like I do as a good Al-Anon. And, you know, somebody there is looking pretty bright and shiny. In the meantime, my husband is off on tour. He, you know, had been drinking. He had been giving me the silent treatment. And I was like, I am not doing what my parents did. I am not staying in a marriage that is unhappy and unhealthy for years. I'm not doing it. And I ended up leaving the 38-year-old. Now, over here at work, this guy, John, is looking very bright and shiny. Very bright and shiny. He's only 2 years older than me. 6'4", 200 pounds. He's the one. He's the one. So I end up marrying John. 3 years later, I gave it a good 3 years, but I married John, who I worked with. You know, we had an office romance. And it was, you know, a whole different energy, but like, oh my gosh. And the, you know, we were friends with all these people and they were getting married. And now I'm like living the California life and I'm married. He's from California. He's from Northern California. So now I'm trying to negotiate. Would you ever move back east? And he's like, never. And I was like, okay. So now I'm going to have to live in California my whole life. And we end up getting married. I marry him. I was 20, 29. And I was married to him for about a year, and he comes to me and he says, I think I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholic, workaholic, whatever, go deal with it. You know, like if you think you're an alcoholic, you go deal with your whatever you think you are. He had met somebody in AA who'd kind of like, they'd started talking, they kind of had a little, you know how men have bromances. So he started having a bromance with some guy who was sober, a recovering crack addict. And they, next thing you know, my husband's like, I think I'm an alcoholic. Okay. And he did love to work. He's a workaholic for sure. And I was like, not my problem. You deal with it. And then, you know, he traveled a lot for business. So I think he did a lot of his drinking when he was out of town. And then I went on a trip with him. I went on a trip with him, and I got to experience his blackout drinking. I was like, what is going on here? Blackout drinking, had no idea what was happening. And then things progressed. His disease progressed really rapidly. He was blackout drinking like 2-3 times a week. And we're in escrow to buy a house. I'm working, we're not working together anymore. I'm working at a different company. We have 2 cars in the garage. We're in escrow to buy a house, and he's blackout drinking. And I'm 29 years old and saying, what is going on here? So one night he said, hey, you wanna go? He had a few too many, or he had too many blackouts. So he said, do you wanna go to an AA meeting? So some guys picked us up, some guys from the Pacific Group in Los Angeles picked us up and took us to the Saturday Night Way of Life meeting in Santa Monica. And we went to the AA meeting, and I don't know, some of you may know Sharon Barker. She spoke that night, and she was my first AA speaker that I heard. And she talked about her higher power being the Beacon's moving truck. And you know, everywhere she went, she would see a Beacon's moving truck. And it was my first time at an AA meeting. And then they said, hey, do you want to go to a watch after? There's this restaurant, Norm's, in Santa Monica. We do watches there. So-and-so is going to have a one-year sobriety party. And so I was like, yeah, I'll go. Sure, I went. So we went, and I sat down, and a couple alcoholics sat with me, and they gave me the number of someone from Al-Anon. Okay, yeah, I put that in my pocket. And then my husband couldn't deal with what was going on. And so he went outside. And then I'm just sitting there chit-chatting away because, you know, I'm a social person and I'll just chit-chat. And then it got to be midnight after the watch. And they're like, where do you think John is? I'm like, I have no idea. They go, do you think we should wait? I said, no, let's just leave him. I was like, let's just leave him. And they're like, wait, you haven't even been to an Al-Anon meeting yet. So we get in the car and we start driving down Lincoln Boulevard, where there's a lot of like really dumpy bars, you know, right there between Venice and Santa Monica. And all of a sudden, John's on the street there. We pull up next to him. They said, we think we should look for him. I said, okay, fine, let's go look. So we find him on the street, and he had been to like 3 or 4 bars. He was totally drunk, out of his mind. And we pick him up, and he's like, hi, what are you doing here? Like, he had no idea, complete blackout. So we go home. They drag him into the house. I said, throw him in the guest bedroom. I go into my bedroom. I lock the door. He starts knocking on the door. I said, go away. So he kept calling them, saying, she won't let me in. And they said, They said, don't worry, we'll come and get you in the morning. Just leave her alone. And so they did come and get him in the morning. And then I, of course, was like, oh my gosh, what has happened with my life here? I'm now 29 years old, married to my second alcoholic, and they've just dragged my husband out of the house at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they're taking him away. And so I did pull out that number that I had gotten from this guy, Hugh, at the meeting, and for this Al-Anon person, and I called her, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting that night. And my husband got sober that day. He got sober that day, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. So I'm eternally grateful for that day, January 7th, 1995. You know, and then we began our journey in recovery. Two different paths. He went to AA, he got a sponsor. I went to Al-Anon, and within about 30 days, I got a sponsor. And welcome to anyone who's new here. We went to our warm-up meeting this morning, and there were some people there who were new. And what I would suggest to anybody is just keep coming to meetings, and please, please get a sponsor. You cannot work this program without a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. She is nothing. We are not alike in any way. I mean, other than we're both affected by alcoholism. She's from Texas. I'm from upstate New York. She calls me a Yankee. But we're both affected by alcoholism, and she's on the path before me. She has, as I mentioned, over 50 years in this program, still working a strong, strong Al-Anon program. And so she said, yeah, I went up to her and asked her if she would be my sponsor. I'll never forget her taking my hand, and her hand felt, it was warm, and it felt like warm butter, you know, like it was a warm touch. I wasn't even used to another woman being warm to me. I didn't have any modeling of that kind of warmth. You know, I worked in the business world. I worked mostly with men. And I had some very rough edges myself. You know, growing up in alcoholism, I think, causes rough edges. You know, growing up in the family that I grew up in caused some rough edges. I had to protect myself. Probably mostly emotionally, but some physical too. So, you know, I wasn't a person who really trusted people. And for some reason, I didn't trust women. I loved men because men gave something to me. Women, not so much, you know. And the beauty of it is what Al-Anon has done for me has given me relationships with women. And I can trust women. And I trust men, too, you know. But I learned to be a woman among many women, because Al-Anon rooms are full of many women, many, many women. And there's a lot of great men in Al-Anon, too, and I love that the Al-Men, too. You know, Palmer's the one who got me here. You know, this guy Palmer, who we're sponsored by the same person. So I got a sponsor, and she'd said, okay, call me every day for 30 days. I was like, oh, gosh, at the same time? Every day? So, you know, that was, you know, you start seeing, like, okay, what are you made of? Like, calling her every day, 30 days. If you missed a day, you had to start over. Jeez. I don't know how many times I had to do it. But anyway, I got through that. And then it was come to 3 meetings a week, go to an open AA meeting, take a commitment at the meeting. And then, so I did that. Okay, and then I had to be on time. Like, I was not a person who was on time at all. When I got to Al-Anon, I was like, you just have to accept me for who I am and when I get here. You know, that was sort of my philosophy in life. And friends would say to me, you know, we really would love it if you'd be on time. And I'd be like, accept me for who I am. I'm late. I run late. So, you know, my sponsor had no, if you're not 15 minutes early for the meeting, at least she'd say you're late. You know, if you're not there, you're late. And so it was, I mean, I'm a person who needed a pretty structured program, a really pretty structured program with somebody who was going to be firm with me. Firm, but loving, you know. In a scary kind of way, because I was used to that. You know, she definitely has a commanding personality. So we would go, I would go to, you know, weekend conferences like this. And uncomfortable, you know, I would be uncomfortable with people, this many people, or women's weekend retreats. Oh, God. You know, can I just go home? Like, this is a lot of women time. And then I started working the steps. And I remember doing my first inventory with my sponsor. And it was like reading someone else's story. I was so detached. I didn't cry. I've cried like, what, 5 or 10 times already? I did not cry. I did not know really how to cry. I still don't love crying, but I know it's, for me, it's part of the process. It's part of like recovery for me to cry. And I'm okay with it. And you guys are, well, except Spencer. You know, everybody else is okay with it. I'm just joking. You know, so I told my story. I gave, you know, I did an autobiographical inventory, read my story to my sponsor, and she was like, I'm so sorry. And then we related and talked about it. And I was like, you're so sorry? Like, what are you so sorry for? You know, and then she handed me my list of character defects, you know. Here you go. Here you go, which I still have my first list of character defects and several other lists after that, too. But one of the things on the list was fear of crying, and then she put /mom. You know, because my mom, she was a weeper. Like, whenever my parents were having problems or my dad, she found out about some infidelity, my mom would sit and like cry in a chair and weep, like in this very like, I don't want to say pathetic way, but like you would just be like, could you just pick it up and move on? You know, like you just, I didn't have a lot of compassion for her. I didn't have a lot of compassion for anybody when I came into this program. I didn't have compassion for her and what she had gone through in her marriage. I didn't have compassion for my husband when he got sober. I was not a compassionate person, you know, not something I'm proud of, but I had gotten a lot of rough edges, and those rough edges and that protection that you put on to survive does not allow a lot of room for compassion. And I don't know if anybody else can identify with that, but for me, I felt, looking back, that's who I was. My sponsor describes me as someone who was very buttoned up and kind of like, not a robot, but, you know, just very tight. So anyway, I started working this program. I kept with it. I went to meetings. There were times when I screwed up. Like, I would, when my sponsor says go to your committed meetings, she doesn't mean that you get to go out with your friends on Thursday night to the, you know, opt out and go to the movies on Thursday night with your friends or whatever. So I had to learn the lesson of, you know, taking the commitment seriously, taking my meeting seriously, that she comes to the meeting, she expects to see me at the meeting. She expects to be on time, that some level of accountability that I really didn't have. I mean, I was a good person, but I didn't have that level of accountability in my life to be on time, to be accountable to other people, that people wanted to see me at the meeting, that I was part of a fellowship, that I was, you know, accountable to my higher power, that I had to create a relationship with my sponsor, I had to get a relationship with my higher power, I had to work at this, I had to work at recovery. So along the way, somewhere in there, my dad was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Didn't go so well for him. I went home, I made amends to him. Went home, sat with him and made amends to him. And he was like, I haven't changed the will. And so, that's a piece of my dad. Like, it's all about the money. And I was like, Dad, this has nothing to do with the money. Like, I'm here to tell you that I was not the best daughter. I sided with my mom a lot. She seemed like the obvious choice. I mean, if you looked at what was happening, she was the obvious one to side with. It's not like she made him out to be the bad guy, but he looked like, he was the bad guy in a lot of ways. He was drinking, he was out, with other women. People, I would have teachers say to me, which one is your father? We grew up in a very small town, and I wouldn't want to say which one was my father, because he had a couple other brothers who were doing probably about the same things he was doing, but they just seemed more estimable, in some way. They were like on the board of the college or something, as well as cheating on their wives. So, so they just looked a little bit better. So I wouldn't want to say which one was my dad. In one class I had when I was a sophomore in high school, this teacher asked me if I could define adultery to the class. Whoa. So I would go home and tell my parents that this teacher had done this to me at school, and I would be pissed off at my dad for that, not the teacher. Like, because how embarrassing that I have to have a teacher say to me, you know what adultery is, can you explain it to the class? So at my dad's funeral, at my dad's wake, they said to me, oh, you have a phone call. And I was like, what? So they said, there's a phone call for you. So I step out of the line, you're greeting people at your father's wake, and I go to the phone, and it's this teacher. He says, guess who this is? I have no idea who this is. Oh, come on, you can guess. What? And so he says his name, and then he says, how are you doing? I said, I'm at my father's wake. I really have to go. And I hang up the phone. Well, the beauty of that story is that at that point, I could say, what an asshole. Sorry, no swearing. Al-Anons don't typically swear from the podium, but what a jerk that guy is. And I didn't think about what a jerk my dad was. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, this guy is a jerk. I don't even know how that story happened. And not to, cause anybody any ill will, but that teacher was recently murdered in a home invasion. I mean, awful, awful, awful. And I certainly don't wish him any bad feelings, but I was like, wow, how could that happen? So that's his end, that's his story. Crazy. So he's probably affected by alcoholism too. I should pray for him. But for me, what it did for me in that moment was I knew my dad was, in that situation, my dad wasn't the problem. So, the forgiveness that the program brought to me for my father through the amends, him telling me how needy my mother was. My mother was very needy. She wanted to, her idea of a perfect relationship is you spend every minute together. And for an alcoholic, I don't know, that's not, that doesn't seem to work well. So he kind of gave me his perspective. And so I was able to see from my dad's perspective a different view of their marriage and life. And, I continued to work this program. I had problems. So my husband stayed sober. He had a sponsor. He was working a program for about the first 5 years. And then he, for some reason, I don't know what got him sober exactly. And I don't know what made him stop going to AA. But my husband stopped going to AA. I continued going to Al-Anon. We had problems getting pregnant. We went through... in vitro, and so successfully I had three children through, you know, the help of good doctors. So I always say, you know, there's little circles of people that help people in the program. So I'm in the, you know, in vitro club. I'm in the alcoholic father club. So I have different clubs within the program that I'm in. So I, you know, certain people have people call people if you've had experience with that. I was brought up in a home where money equaled power. So, you know, of course, I kept my high-powered job, and then I became a mother, and some of those edges smoothed out a little bit. The program helped. I became a better mother through working this program. I ended up quitting my job, which gave me a lot of power, which, you know, in my case was recovery, because I could really, you know, control a lot with the money thing. But I wanted, you know, my second son has some special needs, so I had to kind of pick up in that area as well. So it became, and my husband traveled a lot. He traveled a lot for work. So I gave up my job willingly and wanted to, and became a stay-at-home mom. You know, and as some of those rough edges smoothed, I don't remember how much time I had in the program, but maybe 5 years or so, and women started asking me to sponsor them. And I had some time, you know, I had time, I was a stay-at-home mom, I had time, and I started sponsoring women in this program. And that is a real, real, real gift to giving back in this program, sponsoring other, you know, it's go to meetings, get a sponsor, take commitments, work the steps, sponsor others, and pray on your knees. Very simple. The six things that my sponsor asked us to do: call on time, you know, go to meeting, go to weekends. So I became a sponsor, started working with women, and there's, you know, it's such a pay it forward, pay it back type program. It really, really does. You as a sponsor get more than you give in a lot of these cases. So, you know, I continued on. I was living in Los Angeles. I had been living in Los Angeles for 30 some odd years. I lived in Los Angeles. I became a Californian. Yep, don't ever say you're not going to become something, because you become it, you know. And in the meantime, so my husband stayed sober, you know, was working. We were raising three kids, and life was good, and really enjoying the blessings of the program. You know, the program has given me a really, really good life. I got a relationship with my higher power. I became somebody who was accountable. I don't even know why I started to cry right there. I mean, I'm happy that I'm someone who's accountable. That was not a moment of sadness. It was a moment of, like, I'm happy for who I've become in this program and in my life. Somewhere, you know, I think I'll jump to COVID. COVID happened. I mean, COVID happened. And who would think that COVID could change, you know, people's lives so much? My husband lost his job. And so I look back now and I'm like, oh, I went into Al-Anon mode for sure. I was like, okay, we got this. I got it. I'm going to solve this problem for us, or I'm going to help solve this problem for us. We can consolidate our lives and move to Cape Cod, because we had a house on Cape Cod when my dad died. You know, I had bought this house on Cape Cod. We'll consolidate and we'll move to Cape Cod. Isn't that a great idea? And, you know, I We did. My husband remodeled the house. He lost his job. He had 6 months severance. He's a carpenter guy. He loves doing that stuff. Here's one of my children calling. You're supposed to be at camp. Stop calling. So my husband remodeled the house, got rid of all the knotty pine, you know, made it fresh and new, and it was going to be this new house. And, so we moved to Cape Cod. All the kids are going to school on the East Coast. Everybody's in their spot on the East Coast going to school. And the disease is alive and well at our newly refurbished, bright and shiny house on Cape Cod. The knotty pine might be gone, but the knotty alcoholism is alive and well at my house. You can make a house look perfect and, you know, everything in its spot, but if alcoholism is untreated, the disease is still there. And that would include my disease, because as alcoholism felt more like kind of bubbling up in my house in COVID and through this last couple years, I have been bubbling up as well because of the effects of alcoholism, the effects of Al-Anonism. I qualify myself for this program. I'm still doing the same things. I'm still going to meetings. Some of them are online. I've found a little bit of a niche of meetings at the Cape. And it's hard to say. My husband's still sober, but depression has really, really impacted our house. And, you know, my sponsor's like, you need to go read The Soul of the Sponsorship book, which I have been reading along with Sermon on the Mount. And but in The Soul of the Sponsorship, in the back, it talks about Bill Wilson's secretary talks about his depression. And in the notes in the back, it says Bill Wilson, one of his bouts of depression went 10 years. So I said to my sponsor, 10 years? I gotta wait 10 years? Like, geez. She says, well, it's been a couple. I said, it's been about 5, you know, like, so that, and my I said to my husband something about, you know, his, he goes, why do you have to relate everything to alcoholism? Why you gotta relate everything to alcoholism? I can't say anything at that point. Okay, uncle, you know, so I have to let him have his journey, and his journey is through medication, you know, which his father was a dentist, so I don't know if that tells you anything about, I did happen to say one day, I don't know, it kind of feels like you're following your parents' path, but that's my slip. I shouldn't say things like that. You know, I'm not saying people don't need to be treated medically for depression. I don't have depression, so I can't speak to depression. Am I a more compassionate person than I was when I first came here? Absolutely, I am. And I also have a very long fuse. I'm a very loyal person, and I am suffering living with somebody with depression. So I'm doing one day at a time the best I can, trying to show compassion for the alcoholic. It's hard. It is hard. So in the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, one of the sections in that book talks about, you know, in Al-Anon, we talk about our distorted thinking. You know, thinking really gets us in trouble. So I really, really have to look at my thinking. I grew up in a house with a lot of negative thinking. Oh, you got an A-. Why'd you get an A-? Why are you wearing that dress? You know, I liked your hair better the last time you got it cut. All sorts of comments like that. So as a parent, I really have to look at that also. How do I speak to my children? And I could be known to be perceived as critical. My sponsor talks about the four C's: criticize, compare, condemn, and complain. So I had to have a book that I wrote down every time I criticized, complained, compared, or condemned. You usually figure out pretty quickly which one you are. Well, I'm a criticizer. So I would write about this guy, Roger, that I worked with. She's like, who's Roger? God, he's got a lot of time in this book. You know, Roger did this. Roger did that. You know, I was Roger, Roger, Roger. You know, so I am a critic, and I can focus in on the negative pretty easily. So back to Sermon on the Mount, in I don't know what page it is, but in there it talks about our thinking. Like that I have to work on flipping my thinking, whether that's through a gratitude list, going to a meeting, talking to someone I sponsor, talking to my sponsor, doing something of service, love and service, getting out of that thinking, because that thinking can just, it takes me down a very bad road. And it's so, that's the cunning part of the disease for me. I cannot speak for everybody, but my thinking can get me to the point where I blow, you know, where I will come at you. Oh God, here we go. Here we go with another thought. Okay, here we go. Or here we go. Here he is watching TV again. Here he is sleeping again. Here it is. I'm leaving for work again and he's still sleeping. And the next thing you know, I want to kill him. Okay, so then I get in the car and I start going, God, God, where are you, God? You know, so I start talking to God on the way to work. This is another thing. So all three of my kids left. I became an empty nester in 1 year. I went back to work full time. I'm working full time. I hadn't worked in 20 years. I hadn't worked a full-time job. So I'm back working, employed, underemployed. Maybe I need DA or what is that, underemployed, anonymous, or whatever. But I'm back working. It feels good. It has given me back another level of who I was before, which is really, really nice. In the meantime, I'm still living with alcoholism. And COVID just kind of, you know, so I lost my community. My sponsor said, you got to bloom where you're planted. You got to bloom where you're planted. I don't do moves well. I didn't want to move to California, and I honestly didn't really want to move back east. I had a thriving community. I had a Thursday night meeting with 150 people in it. I sponsor people. I did, you know, it was hard. In your 50s, for me, hard. We met Elaine earlier. She's moved all over and seems to just go with it. I'm like, it's not, I don't know. I'm not good at it. But I keep coming back. I started, the meeting that I went to had to leave meeting location. It had like a clubhouse type thing. So they had to move from that location and they moved to a new place. And so I've been trying to go to meetings at that location, and then they wanted to start an Alateen meeting. And so, great, they're going to start an Alateen meeting. So I said, I want to start an Al-Anon meeting at the same time as the Alateen meeting. So I helped start that meeting at this new location. I was never a meeting. I didn't want to be a meeting starter. When I moved in Los Angeles to a different area, because LA is a pretty big place, so I would drive to my committed meeting at like an hour and 20 minutes to get there on Thursday nights. But I started a meeting with a bunch of other women. So you never have to do anything alone in Al-Anon. So I started a meeting with four or five other women that was closer to my home. But so I would go to my committed meeting that I'd always gone to, and then I'd go to this one that was close by. And their steps and tradition meetings. And you know, that's been super helpful to be able to say, okay, I can just go and start a meeting. All I got to do is print out the format, print out the steps and the traditions, bring a bag for the seventh tradition, and have a topic or, you know, whatever. You don't even have to have a, you can just start with nothing. So if you're not a meeting starter, you can be a meeting starter. You can do anything in this program. I'll close with... you know, I think for me, this program has transformed my life in very meaningful ways, because I can look you in the eye. If I screw up, I can look you in the eye and say, I made a mistake, I was wrong. I'm trying to carry the message the way I got the message. I might not be doing that perfectly. I'm trying to carry the message the way it was given to me. That's very important to my sponsor. I show up, I'm mostly on time. Not always on time, but I really have to talk to myself about being on time, because that's an area that I can slip up in a lot. I'm a good mother. I've been a good mother. I continue to be a good mother. I'm not going to take her call in the middle of a meeting or speaking. The only reason I have my phone up here is so I know what time it is. I love my children. I tell my children that I love them. I tell my husband that I love him. God willing, if we make it, we'll be married 30 years in October. And it hasn't been a straight path. It certainly, life is not a straight road. There's lots of bumps on the road, and we've made it through a lot of the bumps. And, you know, hopefully we'll make it through this bump too. I'm a better daughter. Hopefully I'm a better sister. And a better friend. Than I ever, ever would have been did I not have this program. So thank you, Lou, Ellen, amazing. I'm so happy to have met you. I'm really looking forward to meeting the rest of you, or some of you, whoever wants to come and still smooth off some of my rough edges. Thanks so much.